Before we start this podcast, we would like to take the opportunity to mention that we now have a Patreon page where you can help to support, evolve and continue these compassionate conversations. Please visit patreon.com/vocedialogues for more information. Listen!
Welcome everyone to the Voce Dialogues, Voices of Compassionate Evolution. I'm Chloe Goodchild, founder of The Naked Voice, and this is our new online community where we are exploring, deepening, and evolving our awareness of the transforming power of compassion. Enjoy these new dialogues with a wide range of artists, musicians, writers and philosophers, social entrepreneurs and sacred activists. They are all visionaries, transforming lives through the art of conscious creative expression with practices inspired by their own unique life experience. The Voce Dialogues are dedicated to the compassionate evolution of life on Earth. Well, hello everyone, and it is my incredible pleasure to be in dialogue today with one of my dearest friends, June Burrow. Hello, June.
Hello, Chloe. What a privilege to be doing this with you.
Well, it really feels like it, particularly as we are on New Year's Eve 2021. It couldn't be a better time, I think, to be really exploring the question with you, what is compassion and how has it shown up in your life? And those of you that may not know June, I don't know how to begin to describe you, June. You are such a multifaceted, multi-traveled human being, inwardly and outwardly. I would say my greatest privilege of knowing you in the early days was when you were the head of the Perian Centre in Bristol. But so much before that, so much since that, let's just dive straight in. And I would just love to ask you, what is compassion for you? And I know you have demonstrated this in so many ways in your life. You know, the Perian Centre was instrumental in moving Bristol towards becoming a city of sanctuary, for example, and so much else. So over to you, June.
I've been thinking about this. It's such a huge topic, isn't it, compassion? Mm-hmm. But a few words came to mind that seemed to be underpinning things, and gratitude was one of the first that came to my mind, and then openness and always seeing, if you like, a 360 degree picture. I think we live in a world very ready to judge and make decisions about who someone is or what something is without necessarily sort of going around the back door and seeing what's happening at the back door. We just see the front door and go, oh goodness me, that's how it is. And maybe that isn't the full picture. And I think I learnt a lot of that from my father in particular, who in a way was my best friend in life. And there was a time when we had a right royal family ruckus. I'm not going in the details of that, but there was a moment when I had a phone call with my father and he said, darling, really what matters is whether you're happy or not. And that level of compassion in this kind of mayhem of relatives all kind of taking sides and everything was such an extraordinary lesson to me about, at the end of the day, the openness of, I'm not going to make a judgment here. What you have to do is decide what's the right path for you to take. And I think that generosity of spirit is really important. And I think I brought that into the Perian Centre because, in a way, it was a very unconventional business. I decided not to run it like a business, but to try and do it as an example of how we could run businesses slightly differently on a different set of parameters. And so I simply had three very simple fundamental values when I opened the Perian Centre. One was the belief that every single human being is remarkable and that we demonstrate our remarkableness much better when we're given opportunities and love and care and compassion and support than if we're not. The second was that any business that sets itself up needs to be part of the community in which it exists, because I saw a lot in my previous work of businesses that were kind of somehow separate and didn't see the impact and power that they had in the local community or the bigger community of the world. And just that philosophy astonished me, really, because it ended up with us doing all sorts of things that was never in the business plan, Chloe. It was just like we started doing things in the community because there was a philosophy that that's what we should be doing. Very last third thing, which I think is where compassion really comes in, was that our job was only one thing, and that was to take care of everyone who came to the door. So when new people joined the team, I used to just take them around, show them the ropes and say, but your bottom line here is you take care of everyone who comes through. And taking care means taking care of not just the customers, not just the team, not just the people who deliver food, not just the people who do deliveries. Anyone who comes to the door is to be taken care of. And then the whole philosophy of that was a kind of coffee room where people could literally have tea or coffee at any time of the day and evening. And that was sort of on free flow. And then people used to say, what we love about the Peering Centre is the chocolate biscuits and the lilies in the toilets, because again, the toilets for me were a real, I know it sounds really funny, but clean toilets is such a sign of care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we check the toilets at the beginning of the day, at the coffee break, at the lunch break, at the tea break, at the break between the afternoon and the evening, at the end of the day, because that felt to me like it's a demonstrable example of taking care. And for me, that was never a menial lower task. It was one of the most important things we did. And so I was reversing the kind of concept of what really matters in life to say, actually, taking care needs demonstrable, visible things. And that felt to me to be part of it. And hopefully we did that. We reckoned that by the end of 10 years of the Peering Centre, we may possibly have impacted directly or indirectly on about 1 million lives. Mm-hmm. And we did it one person at a time, believing that every one of them was remarkable and taking care of every one of them.
Goodness me. Goodness me. And that's just, I mean, you've just really painted such a wide landscape of principles that have to be embodied, skillfully embodied, right? In order that they can be literally practiced. And you're talking about such profound principles, really, and the practice of those principles in a non-religious, non-institutionalized way, you know. And that I always remember when I came to the Peering Centre, that was just how it was. You always seem to be, even though you were clearly multitasking in the background, you always seem to be just like this sort of incredibly gracious hostess of the building, you know, just floating around, just being incredibly available to people. And I obviously knew you over time. I knew what was really going on and what aspects of life in the city, in this incredible city of Bristol, that you transformed, that the Peering Centre transformed. Could you just give people a little bit more detail about the Peering Centre? Why did it have that name, and how did the vision for that happen?
Well, and I'm just going to pick up on the, you know, looking calm. We often in our team meetings used to talk about swans, you know, that it's all lovely on the surface and the swans floating around underneath their patterns. And that was a common metaphor in our team meetings, you know, but we've got to make it look like we're swans, but underneath our little feet are really working hard. The Peering Centre, I mean, it was a dream 10 years in the making. And I need to go back to 1991 when I went to Australia, which was an extraordinary sabbatical. I left with an open-ended ticket with no idea when I would, if ever, come back to the UK. And I got very happily stuck in Australia for 16 months for all sorts of personal reasons. I had friends who were ill with HIV, AIDS and dying, and I just thought I'd need to be here. And in that process, I went up to see my boyfriend at the time in Arnhem Land, which is an Aboriginal settlement. And within 3 days, they decided to adopt me, which is an extraordinary privilege, the greatest privilege of my whole life, I think. Mm. And when I said to Cookie, my boyfriend, oh, well, you know, they've done that because of all the good work you're doing, he said, June, it doesn't work like that. There are people who've worked here for 25 years. They're adopting you because they know you've got something to do and you're not going to be here for very long, which was more than I knew. You know, I thought I was up there sort of for ages. Anyway, 5 weeks later, I left and then began this idea of having a centre that would be a place where I lived and worked and shared with people and was all about encouraging and supporting everybody in the journey to be the best person that they're capable of being in every way. And that has been, and I think, my life's work. Even when I was a management consultant, you know, I would still have that as my fundamental thing of my job is to help people be the best manager or the best team person or the best whatever director of a company. And that was very much about coming back to the center core of who someone is rather than, oh, now I'm a manager, I've got to behave like this or do this. So that was a fundamental principle in my work of facilitating growth of people into being the best of what they are. And I thought, wouldn't it be lovely to buy 40 acres of bushland and just build somewhere sort of with a central piece and outside quiet rooms and places to go, which, you know, would be places to just sit and be quiet. And as you say, none of this comes from a particular spiritual belief or a particular political angle. It was just a sort of thing that I was growing and developing an idea about, and that there'd be a room for work and a room for study and a room for fun and a room for eating and rooms for sleeping, and so that each room had its kind of function and purpose. And for lots of reasons, I couldn't stay in Australia, and I came back to the UK in 1992 heartbroken and took 18 months to just get over the tragedy that I wasn't going to live in Australia. And I was walking past a building one day, and into my head came this thought, oh my word, wouldn't that make a wonderful centre? And I sat down and I thought, actually what I thought was, oh bugger, this is never going to go away.
You know that one? Yeah.
And so that was 1992.
Yeah.
And I finally bought 27 Portman Square in 2001. So it was a long, it was a dream, 10 years in the making, of looking at properties, going through all the sort of breaking down the barriers of how on earth do I get the money to do this? I sold my flat, all sorts of kind of long, long story. And we opened in 2002, and we opened with everybody I'd ever known got invited to the opening to say thank you, because that for me was the reason I was there, was a culmination of everything I'd ever known or explored, or friendships and love that I'd had, and influences and inspirations. And so it was just a big party, really. And someone asked me, they said, well, what's the Peering Centre going to be? And I said, I've got no idea. It'll just organically grow into whatever it's supposed to be. And he said, oh, that's a rubbish business plan, I give you a year. So we did 9.5 years before we actually closed. So
amazing.
And the reason we called it the Peering Centre is that we were looking for a name that I wanted to call it the Anahata Centre, because that's the heart chakra in Sanskrit. And everything for me was coming from this principle of, you know, if you come from the heart, from love, from compassion and openness, then, you know, life seems to me to be a little bit better than if you come from other places. But people said, oh, you can't call it Anahata Centre because, you know, everyone will think you're kind of aged hippies and, you know, going around in sandals with beads around your neck. And I thought, OK, it was going to be a conference facility for businesses. Mm-hmm. So we found a quote from Alexander Pope, a little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian Spring. And I rang my parents and I said, get your encyclopedias out. What is the Pierian Spring? And it turned out to be the spring of water on Mount Olympus where the muses got their water from. And so the word Pierian has become synonymous with of knowledge and inspiration. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, okay, that is it. That is what I want the Peering Centre to do. I want it to give knowledge and inspiration. And then with knowledge, people can do the best they can do. You know, I think knowledge in itself isn't enough. You have to then be inspired to act and actually do something with the knowledge that will kind of contribute into the world. And the best contribution I think anyone can give is to be the fullness of who they are. I honestly believe that if we can just be the fullness of who we are in every exchange and in every moment of life, it's the best gift that anyone can give.
Well, it's incredible that you're sharing this at this time, isn't it? Literally in the world where we're watching the collapsing of an old paradigm. I always had this sense about you that you were ahead of your time because you have this incredible all-inclusiveness around what you're doing. And yet your attention to detail and to, you know, the practicalities, the groundedness of the project, whatever it is, the initiative, is absolutely fundamental to it. And what I hear behind what you are speaking about is just this innate human quality for which the flowing spring is the most perfect metaphor, really, which is that just just that bubbling spring of life, of awareness, of love, as you say, that combines knowledge with practical awareness. And just to be hearing you speak about this right now, I'm almost thinking, goodness, I wish you were the Prime Minister of the country, quite frankly, right now.
But well, you, it last about 30 seconds in there. I'm not speaking, I think.
But you see, the point is, what you're sharing is clearly so natural to you. It just arises through and from you so spontaneously, this understanding, which you demonstrate all the time. I mean, that's just always been my experience of you. I remember when we had that concert, there were so many things you did. And I'd love you to perhaps also just point a little bit to the Bristol as a city of sanctuary as well. Just prior to that, I'm remembering for myself how privileged I was to be involved in that project with you, where we brought together different musical cultures of the city. And it wasn't until then that I realized from you just how many cultures were in Bristol City and how much musicality that represented. And again, as another metaphor, along with the spring, is this awareness of how music itself, and how shared music, of course, music of the spirit, as well as instrumental or vocal music, really does dissolve separateness, dissolve that lack of all-inclusiveness that you really embody yourself and have demonstrated so beautifully.
I think the arts generally do that in lots of different ways. And I come from a theatre background. I was a stage manager for 10 years. I've done everything in decades, really. So my first decade was as a stage manager.
Wonderful. Wow.
You know, and that kind of general kind of artistic element was also, I mean, I grew up with my father playing the piano and my mother doing a lot of, she painted Redoute roses, copied them, and they were absolutely fantastic. So I grew up in a very creative artistic environment. And I think that what the creative arts generally do is they allow voice for the unheard and they allow visibility for the unseen. And so as a child, if you don't quite know how to say something, you draw a picture or you sing it or you play a piece of music. And in that space, you can be seen and heard in a way that it's very hard sometimes to speak. And then, as you say, you know, the thing about all of these things, particularly music, is that in the moment of music, you are all drawn into that space, which always feels to me like it's a sort of emotional space that bypasses the brain completely and just goes straight to the heart. And so you hear a piece of music and you start crying. I mean, there's no kind of, oh, do I like this or don't I like it? It just moves us as a kind of process. And I think bypassing the intellect is quite a good thing sometimes, because it gets in the way of us just being able to be who we are, because it's like, is this the right thing to do? And should I do it? And shouldn't I do it? And all of that kind of stuff, which has its place and is very valuable, but not when it obliterates the instinctive, intuitive knowledge of what we really need to be. Because that's what I think so often we're living with now, is a kind of cover-up of those instincts and intuitions are being kind of suppressed.
Yes.
And music and the arts and love and hugging and laughing and all these things, I think, bypass all of that intellectual stuff. You know, when you hug someone, you don't stand there thinking, is this the right thing to do or not, do you? You just hug them because it's a complete and utter connection with someone. When you sing with people or you make music together, there's no sort of intellectual kind of, am I doing the right thing here? Well, there might be a kind of, am I singing the right note? As someone who sang in choirs, you know, and as a soprano, where if you get it wrong, it usually is pretty. And I'm like, oh my God, that was not a good idea. I think the reason that the Peering Centre got into so much artistic stuff, and actually that the launch of Bristol as a city of sanctuary was a huge artistic event. People singing and dancing and, you know, all sorts of activities that brought the city together. And for the first time in history, we had the civic leaders of the city walking down the cathedral aisle hand in hand with refugees. I don't think that has ever happened before in that cathedral. And that was because the cathedral, you know, with Tim Higgins as the canon, was really keen to be part of that. And the council and the council house, you know, wanted this kind of conglomeration of everything. And I think that universality, you know, if you start from the premise everyone's remarkable, you can't do hierarchy, because no one's better than someone else, no one's more intelligent than someone else. We're all bringing ourselves to the table, and ourselves are of value. inherently, regardless of position or rank or the role that we have in life. We are all of value. And I think that's been an underpinning thing. And I don't know where it came from, but I remember, you know, as a child, sometimes hearing adults saying things and thinking, well, that's not right. That's very unjust and unfair, you know, which I think was quite influential. And I think I just want to kind of honour a few moments in my life. So when I first started working, after I'd left the theatre, I worked in career change counselling and outplacement when a lot of redundancies were being made in the 80s. And my then boss, Jill, got me in one day. She said, June, I want to make you the training director. And I said, oh, don't be silly, Jill. I haven't got a clue. She said, no, you're a natural. And I found a course, went on a course, and the rest is history, as they say. But what I've always recognised in her and Peter Gray, who then later in my life said, I think you should come and help me on this course that I'm doing, a start your own business. And I said, well, I don't know anything about management. He said, June, you ran the Bristol Old Vic Theatre as a stage manager and company manager. Of course you do. It's just you haven't read the books, but you know about it. And those two people saw in me something which I couldn't see myself, and I've always honored them and thought I can never pay them back, but what I can do is do that for other people. So I see talent, and I mean the Peering Center was an example of dozens of people who came to work with us and help us and in all sorts of ways, just going, yeah, okay, let's just work with this person and help them be more of who they are, because that's what Jill and Peter were doing with me. They helped me be more of who I was because I couldn't see that I could do it. And I think that ability of any of us to just go, actually, I think you've got a particularly amazing talent here, so I'm going to support and help you grow that talent, is a fundamental thing in my life, really. And I think it was influenced hugely when I was 16 years old and my best friend got a brain tumor, and I went to see her 3 weeks before she died, and she was incontinent and incoherent. And I can remember just looking at her and thinking, okay, death is going to be a great release for her because life was ended, really. But this is a lesson to me that we can still see great beauty in the friendship that we'd had, and it will always be part of my life. Even though she's died, nobody can ever take that away from me. And that also it was a kind of, right, June, you better live your life because you never know when the Grim Reaper might come along and kind of slice your head off. Now, 55 years on, actually, I'm still here, but I've kind of lived my life with that kind of, you never know when, so just do it. So what we did at the Peering Centre a lot was people would come to the door with an idea and I'd just go, OK, yes. And sometimes the team would say, oh, goodness, June's going out for a drink or a cup of coffee. And when I'd get back, they'd go, OK, what have you said you're going to do now? And it would be some big event like, you know, Tom Stoddart's banners at Temple Meet Station of all his photographs, which was a huge kind of major exhibition of 15 4-meter square banners hanging off Temple Meads platform 5. And that was basically, you know, I'd gone out for a drink with Tom and John Easterby to sort of discuss whether we could do something at Temple Meads, and with each glass of wine we drank the banners got bigger and bigger. But the other marvelous thing, we then went to the station master and said, this is what we want to do, and he said yes, and I said, I'm sorry, I just need you to say that one word again, and he said yes. And I think that's the other thing, you know, you learn in life that what you need to surround yourself with people who say yes, and then everything is possible. What seems impossible and never going to happen happens when a whole load of people just say, yeah, let's do it, and we'll work out how. And then you've got that capacity, you know, that exhibition spoke to, I think, I can't remember what the footfall of Temple Meads, it's about 20,000 people a day, and it was up for 3 months, and I have no idea what impact those photographs had and what changes people made in their lives as a result of them. I'll never know. And I think that's the other thing with compassion, is that you do something from your heart for giving people a voice or visibility, and you then just have to trust the process is going to take that to a place in the people who see or experience it with which they will do the best they are capable of doing. And you'll never know when you do things. You never know how many people or what, but you just have to know that they will.
You're giving us a kind of, it feels like it's just a really dynamic manual for skills for compassion is what I'm hearing. You know, it's just, it's so important what you're describing. It couldn't be more relevant for now. You know, when we're seeing so many people polarizing because of this absence of these skills that you're talking about, or absence of this awareness, or because they went to a school where music, the arts were just like so low status that they never got to access what you're describing, or kind of just very limited institutionalized backgrounds where, you know, dogmatic language was right and everything else was wrong. But what I hear you doing and what you're demonstrating compassion to be is that it has to be lived in the moment. It has to be this positive, direct from the heart experience, but not something that's floaty, but something that is really anchored, really tethered.
Since the Perian Centre, I mean, for those listening, I left Bristol after I closed the Perian Centre. So we closed it in 2011, again, with big party, because we all seem to do big parties at the Perian Centre. So
that's another lovely metaphor.
The last day of the Perian Centre, I think about 700 or 800 people came, and we had a big event at the end, and everyone went out into the square. And this was December, you know, with little lights and lots of, and it was really, really beautiful. And eventually I got the message that I needed to move from Bristol, which took me a bit of time, you know, because I was a bit stuck after that, you know, and people were sort of introducing me as this is June, who used to run the Perian Centre, which isn't a good place. And I moved to North Wales 7 years ago. So when was that? 2015. So it took me 4 years to kind of get my head around what I needed to do. And that kind of anchoring process that we're talking about, you know, I live within sight of the mountains, within sight of the sea, and with a river on my boundary, which right now, after all the rain, is absolutely roaring and just so dramatic and energetic. And I am out in nature. Well, I am nature, so I shouldn't say out in nature. You know, I experience all of that as part of myself. And I think it's a really important thing that life is quite challenging at the moment, particularly, and it's quite challenging to hold that space of love sometimes, because the vibrations get quite extreme for me, of kind of like, oh, why can't people see? And for me, that anchoring of just being in the mountains, walking up to the lake, listening to the river, the strength of the mountains and the energy of the river and the calmness of the landscape, and, you know, the cleansing of the rain, which we get a lot of up here, and the kind of warmth of the sun, and all those things which just hold that space for us to go, this is what I am. It is who I am. We aren't opposite to nature. We are of it, and we're in it, and it is us. And so here I am now, you know, I've moved from a big event driven thing to a small holiday cottage and lodgers in my house and a little bit of coaching and a little bit of kind of, but I now realize that already hundreds of people have come here to stay in the cottage. And again, you know, I do all the changeovers and the cleaning, and I put flowers around, and it is a business, and it's my income to pay my bills. But on top of that, it's to share all of what I've just talked about with as many people as I can, because when they come here, they hear, they feel, they see the magic of the mountains and the river and the sea and the landscape, and they are restored in some way to the kind of central place where we all come from. And even if they're only here for 2 nights, you know, I see the difference. And so for me, again, this wasn't just setting up a business. And we've recently done a whole load of landscaping with paths down to the river with the wonderful Bertwin and Islian, who helped me with everything. And for them, I think at the beginning, it was, we've got a job, we build a path, we build a wall, we put the hardcore down, and we run around with diggers and dumpers, and, you know, it's all right. Within 12 hours of the first bit being finished, someone was sitting on the patio with a cup of coffee. Within another 24 hours, someone was in the glade sitting on the bench. Within another 24 hours, someone was sitting on the little stone bench we'd inserted into one of the walls they'd built. And I wrote to them both and I said, I just want to say thank you. You haven't just made paths. You have created a place of sanctuary. And people already, instantly, those paths were there and the benches were there and the seats were there. Instantly. People just use them. And so when we're doing a job, you know, we're not just doing the job, we're creating something which is so much bigger. And for people here now to have that same experience of sanctuary that I think the Perian Centre gave a lot of people. And I think that's the last thing I would sort of tie up with, this kind of sense of, if people know that they are believed in, if they know they can just be who they are, if they know, in fact, not that they can just be who they are, but they're applauded for being who they are. There is a sense of safety suddenly in a world where so often we're told you can't be like that and you mustn't do that and you should do this and you ought to be, suddenly in a place which just goes, actually, hello, I'm June and you're Chloe and that's who we are. And I'm absolutely meeting people at that level of you are who you are. And I'm aware that I sort of do the same up here, completely different arena, but I guess the common denominator is me. So I suppose it shouldn't come as a surprise that even though it's not a great big razzmatazz place like the Peering Centre was, it's still already, you know, I've had hundreds of people come and stay here and, you know, guests, people who come and help as volunteers to help in the garden, lodgers, friends, lots of friends who love coming up here just as a kind of place to just reconnect. And I think we're reconnecting every time with our heart and our soul. I'm kind of realizing as time goes on that that's such a gift, you know, that compassion is the gift of saying to someone, I love you as you are. And in these very, very awkward times that we're in, that's where I'm discovering that although a lot of us around here have very different perspectives on what is happening, we're all finding that place of love. And in that place of love, we can disagree, and it's not always easy. It's sometimes quite painful, but it arrives at a place of respect of each other because the love goes deeper. If you let it, if you find that place of love, it has a channel deeper than the kind of divisiveness that's going on at the moment. And I think that's been a real lesson to me.
Well, it's also for me, I've been lucky enough to visit and to stay with you, and obviously leaving where you know, the sacred environment that you've constellated there with the people and with nature and again with the river. So it's now we've moved from the bubbling spring to a rushing, roaring, mighty river, you know, with the mountains and all of that. You've really painted a beautiful, you've not only painted a beautiful picture of what compassion is, but how it can be lived, and how, if you really just follow your heart, that the inner activism, the social activism, the sacred, the political activism, all of those motivations of the spirit really come back to this sovereignty of me. I love what you just said just now. It all happens because of me. And very often me is thought to be this kind of personality, social, am I doing well? Am I impressing you? Me. But I know, we know the me you're talking about is the compassionate me that knows it's in service to this greater work that is happening planetarily as well as right here at our own hearth. June, I thank you so much for just literally, I think there's so much more to share. I think we'll have to follow up with a few more of these Voce dialogues, because what you have shared is so rich. And I really know that people will want, certainly I will, want to listen and re-listen to everything that you've shared here, to unpack it and just to take it in and just to go, okay, am I up to that? Am I embodying that yet? Do I understand that? Is that a missing piece of compassion in my life? Because as you say, it's the natural, spontaneous outpouring of love that really is at the heart of compassion. And that is, your life has always demonstrated that in such an inspiring way. I can't wait to come and stay with you again.
And I can't wait to have you here again. You know, it's been absolutely special, because I think sometimes we also need to just remind ourselves, and through talking it out, it's kind of, oh yeah, that's what I'm doing here now. And I think my last thought, you know, the Peering Centre was a very razzmatazz out there, right in the heart of Bristol, connected with all the great and good. And I have an ego the size of a house, you know, I loved it because it was a real kind of, I could see that I was doing a lot and more. And it's completely different here because it's not that public profile any longer. And it's taken a while to just trust that actually you don't need to always do it like that. If that's where you're at, that's where you're at. But you can actually also do it in a much quieter, less public, less obvious way. And that's okay too. And so, you know, reflecting on this conversation has been just a joy and a privilege. And thank you so much.
It just feels like every time I talk with you and we connect together, it's compassion as homecoming also. That's always my sense with you. That's really what it comes down to. Thank you so much, June. Thank you.